With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
You are listening to Claret and Blue, an Aston Villa podcast brought to you by Birmingham Live. Hello, welcome to the Claret and Blue podcast. My name is Dan Rowlands and I'm joined by my colleague Matt Kendrick. Matt, how are you, mate?
I'm all right, mate. I'm a little bit flat. How are you?
Yeah, same. My Wi-Fi has been bad all day. We've had power cuts, so bear in mind any technical problems. We've got Matt Davis on standby. You've seen him maybe once or twice before listening. It didn't, the off chance I disappear. Loads of comments flooding through on YouTube already. People waiting for the stream to start. And David Ham says, where's Matt Kendrick to make sense of all this? So Matt, you're here now. Tell us what you've seen this afternoon at Anfield.
It's funny that David Ham should be asking for Kendrick, because it's normally Kendrick asking for Ham. I'm back. Make sense of it. I don't know. I thought Liverpool were there to be beaten today, to be honest. Mm. You know, we know they've had this kind of ropey record at Anfield, and same old thing, isn't it? You know, you're struggling. Who should come along to put you back on the right path? It's Aston Villa. I just thought Villa lacked a bit of intensity, to be honest. Even with the Alexander Arnold, fair play to him as ping one in the bottom corner, you know, in the last moments of the game, and brilliant finish. But you know, we know what he's Gareth Southgate might not know what he's capable of, but we know what he's capable of. So why are we not getting closer to him in the last minute of the game? You know, you've already kind of put in a performance that could have got a win, but should have got a point, and then you're just standing off people with that quality in the last moments of the game. So I don't know. I thought it had a little bit of a ring of the game at Villa Park. Not the game at Villa Park this season, the game at Villa Park the previous season. You know, when we got our noses in front without Jack Grealish again that day. And then there was a kind of sting in the tail late on again. So, just miserable and flat, to be honest, on an afternoon where I thought, having turned the corner late on against Fulham last weekend, we could have kind of really kind of made a statement that we, you know, this season's not dead, that we still want to kind of finish with a flourish. And I think we kind of wasted that opportunity today.
Just talk me through the goals. There's been a lot of people talking about kind of poor defending from Villa and being a bit lazy or standing off. I will admit, I didn't see the second goal because I had a power cut, so not even seen. As far as I'm concerned, it was 1-1. I'm pretty happy with that. Talk me through the goals, and was it poor Villa or good Liverpool?
I think the first goal was, again, I think Liverpool played through Villa a bit too easily. And then, you know, should Tyrone Mings have reacted a bit faster, knowing that Mo Salah is sniffing around him for the rebound? Possibly so. But I think the last goal, obviously that goal was frustrating, because I don't think Villa made Liverpool work hard enough for the goal, to be honest. And I think the winning goal from Alexander Arnold, you know, Martinez has pulled off a brilliant save in the midst of it, you know, a point blank range save. And having done that, having protected the goal that way, you think that the players around him are going to do their damnedest to stop, you know, to clear the danger. But yeah, I thought the frustrating thing was that, you know, probably a minute earlier at the other end of the pitch, Barkley's had an opportunity where Watkins has found him. Barkley, to be fair, has found himself in space, and Watkins has picked him out with a great ball. And then I don't know who it was. I think Barkley's ummed and ahed over trying to get his shot away and then running to another Villa player, and the opportunity's gone. Then lo and behold, down the other end of the pitch, Villa have blown it. So I just found it was disappointing all round, because we're not facing a Liverpool of last season. We're facing a Liverpool of this season. A Liverpool who are down on the look because the home form has been so crap, and a Liverpool who are down on the look because they've got it all to do in the Champions League. You know, that's the time to turn the screw. You've got in front. You've not only have you got in front, but you've, you know, come out on the right side of an offside call going into half time, you've got to be more streetwise. You've got to be better and a lot more together than Villa were in the second half. But I think that's the frustrating thing. You know, we're probably arguing the toss, aren't we, over whether Villa finish, I don't know, 12th or 13th or something like that. So in the grand scheme of things, it might not make that much of a difference. But I just think, you know, it's a wasted opportunity.
That's the words out of my mouth. I was about to say, do you think that's a wasted opportunity to go 1-0 up just before half time, and then you get the like you said, the right side of the VAR call, which we've talked about VAR a hell of a lot on this podcast, and even watching that as a Villa fan, it went in our favour, and ultimately it's not impacted the result anyway, but that was a mental decision. I don't think that's offside, it's level, isn't it? And we've got away with one, but you think that as a football fan, I think, God, this is rubbish, isn't it? But that's the opportunity for Villa to go on and push on then, and like you said, put Liverpool to the sword and maybe go two up front or switch things up a bit, and we don't do that, and that's why it's frustrating, you think?
Yeah, I mean, a frustrating thing for me, and this is I think I've used this phrase before. I think it's what Martin O'Neill used to call a Monday morning quarterback, which I think is the same as being wise after the event. Basically, we can all say what went wrong, you know, when it's already happened. It's a bit harder for managers in real time to make these decisions. But I thought Smith got his substitutes bang on last week. We're going to say that because they ended up winning the game. I just felt it was a bit strange today that you know, and I don't want to reinvent. Keenan Davis as the next Ronaldo, and I meant fat Ronaldo, not new Ronaldo. I don't want to invent him as that, but he'd done enough in that last 15 minutes against Fulham to not necessarily start. I'm not saying he should have started, but I think he should have definitely been an option from the bench, because he must have been buzzing, hadn't he? You know, Dean Smith will have seen how he's trained this week, but you imagine Keenan Davis, having waited so long for an opportunity and made the most of it last week, must have been really kind of feeling strong and confident. So any kind of benefit that they've had from that a week ago now is going to be, you know, lost by the time he plays the next game. So I think crying out for him to come on when Traore went off, to be honest, I think that was a missed opportunity. Just to give Villa a little bit more energy up there, because I think by that stage of the game, I think McGinn was finding it difficult to get up alongside, you know, to give Watkins much support up there. And I just think Keenan Davis would have been an option to give Liverpool something to think about. I think Liverpool kind of eased their way into that victory at the end, because they weren't having too much to contend with in their own kind of third, if you like. So, you know, it was just them eventually cranking up the quality to see off Villa. And I don't think Villa provided enough resistance to stop that happening. And I don't think the substitutions that Dean Smith made, you know, did enough to stop that happening either.
The comment from Gareth, who says, Matt, I'm sorry, but I've noticed every time you come on the show, we get beat. Sorry, stay out of here. get back to father's side.
Right. I mean, I don't mind. I'd gladly just be sitting downstairs eating Doritos, to be honest. So, if I'm the jinx, that's fine. I'm happy to just chat, go on memory lane into the ones with the former players and leave the match day ones to the lucky omens.
Yeah, let's talk about Ross Barkley a bit, because we talk about him every single week when he doesn't play, so we'll better talk about him when he has come on and played. That felt like a strange substitution to me as well. Jacob Ramsey looked like he coming on at one point with Douglas Luiz going down injured, and that never happens. And you expect that when there is a substitution that he'd be up on the priority list to come on first. And then Ross Barkley, who's not featured for weeks and has been behind Ramsey in every instance, gets almost half an hour. Doesn't do a lot with it, and that's one of those ones that leaves me scratching my head thinking, one, why is he even come on in the first place, and two, why is he still not grasping this opportunity of trying to impress?
No, you're right. I mean, I suppose this is cliche time, but I suppose on the day of the Grand National, Smith will say it's horses for courses, and there's clearly something that's put Barkley in front of his thinking, you know, ahead of the other options today. I'm not sure what that is. And I don't want to kind of, you know, crank up the witch hunt for Ross Barkley. But I think it's fair to say that he is so far removed from being the player that he was during the reverse fixture when Villa kind of toyed with Liverpool. I just don't think, have we seen Barkley play well without Grealish?
I don't think so. I think his best team. Football
listen, I know we've only seen Grealish missing for the last couple of weeks, and Barkley has not been on the pitch much. So, you know, he's not had much opportunity to show that he can play well without Grealish. But I'm not sure. I think Barkley, certainly in the early part of the season, came alive when Grealish was occupying defenders here and there. Then he gave Ross Barkley that kind of that space, that confidence, you know, the chance to be Jack Grealish's foil. I think, you know, Barkley to me should have the quality and the experience and the ability to not to be Jack Grealish, but to be able to provide that kind of quality when Jack's not around, you know. So I don't know. I feel like he's an easy one for us to dig out, but that probably comes with from being who he is. Do you know what I mean? He's an England international. He's moved for big money in his career. We know what he's capable of. We know we've seen glimpses of it in a Villa shirt. So we're probably judging him by really, really high standards. But this is the Premier League. You know what I mean? This is a player who's come from a kind of Champions League contending club to, you know, he should be one of Villa's top two or three players routinely every week because of where he's come from and what he's capable of doing. And he's not even in the top 14 at the moment, because when he's coming off the bench, he's not impacting the game. So, you know, I think we can safely say that Ross Barkley, you know, I don't think he'll be back at Aston Villa next season. You know,
I don't think he'll be back.
I think, you know, if this...
Sorry, I agree. I don't think he'll be back, but if you had the choice, would you have him back? Do you think there's a bit of a gem in there to polish up?
No, I don't think so, because, you know, I think if we saw the statement that Villa put out yesterday, you know, talking about the accounts and where Villa are and where they want to be as a club, and there's an interesting line in there. And I don't think it's rocket science. I don't think it's come as a surprise to any of us. But there's a line in there talking about how the recruitment and how their recruitment is to kind of, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but to get talent and potential talent on the way up, get them pinned down on long contracts, and make sure they've got an asset there, either for the good of the football club in terms of getting them in the team, or for the good of the football club, they've got to sell on value. I don't think Barkley, I mean, Barkley's not that old, is he? How old is he? About
27 maybe.
Yeah, I mean, he's not that old, but I don't think he fits the profile of what Villa want. I think Villa want, kind of like I said, they want to be the talent spotters. They want to get these gems who they can polish and turn into kind of valuable assets. And I think Barkley, bless him, he's probably, you know, I'm not saying Barkley's over the hill and on his way down. I'm sure there's a player in there who can be revived again. But I don't think it makes financial sense for Villa to turn this loan spell into a permanent deal, especially when, you know, some of the figures that we were hearing last summer, you know, upwards of 30, 40 million quid. Yeah. I think that money can be better spent than on Ross Barkley.
I think even if it's 10 to 12 million, I think you might be able to find better money, to be honest, as well, with it, if you consider his wages as well. The comment from Connor here, he says, if the season fizzles out and we're finished 12th, is the season a disappointment, especially given Villa's start? Strange after last season, but disappointing in this group since December. And this is what the whole one-man team thing that we've talked about is annoying, because we were rubbish with, well, not rubbish, but we were having rubbisher games. Rubbisher? What am I talking about? We're having games with Jack Grealish when Villa weren't doing great either. So it's not just that we've taken Grealish out and all of a sudden we're poor. Obviously, without him, it's going to be a struggle. But even with him, we've had bad games since Christmas. That's 4 months now that Villa have had a bit of a wobble that we keep talking about. Does that make it a disappointing season, if you finish 12th, 13th, 14th?
I mean, first of all, I think I need a red pen to mark your grammar and your made-up words.
Sorry about that.
I've never heard you be rubbisher than that. It's weird, isn't it? Because we're in the midst of a season now, so we can't take a step back and take stock, because it's still happening, and we still think that Villa can influence games and put on good performances and win matches. There's still the capability to do that. But I think when we look back, when the season finishes and we look back, I think I've said this before, but I'll say it again. If this season would have happened in reverse, and we'd have been really crap to start with, and then we'd have pulled out that kind of run of form that we showed earlier in the season. Over the course of the season, we'd have still been half crap and half good, but the good would have been the most recent in memory. I think the problem is that we've we've set the standards and we've shown that we can compete. Yeah. And having done that, almost kind of made a rod for our own back, because anything less than that now, not, I wouldn't say it's unforgivable, because people have peaks and troughs and these inconsistencies of all football teams, but it's, what are Villa? Are Villa that? Or are they that? Or is it somewhere in the middle? But I don't know. To me, what was it founded on earlier in the season? You know, the success that they had was founded on, obviously, a strong platform at the back that didn't give too much away. I still think that exists to a degree, although I think some poor defending has crept in, and we'll come to that in a minute. But it was founded on a kind of an intensity as well in forward areas. It was founded on Ollie Watkins not being a lone presence up front, but having a lot going on around him. You know, whether that was Grealish and Barkley, whether that was whichever winger turned up that week early in the season, you know, that's not happened anymore. Yeah. And I think, to me, the league position is less concerning over what Villa are and what Villa's style of play is. And the big issue that, let's face it, you know, and I'm not saying this is because Jack Grealish is necessarily going to leave anytime soon, but what are Villa without Jack Grealish? You know, and that's the frustrating thing today, that they've proved that it can be competitive without Jack Grealish, but then not be streetwise enough to protect a lead or protect a draw. So it'd be disappointing in the sense that we're all looking, trying to dig out our passports, weren't we? You know, 3 months ago. So whatever happens, you know, Villa aren't going to finish in Europe now, are they? I don't think. So it'd be disappointing in that sense. But I don't think across the course of the whole season, I don't think we need to be that, you know, harsh on Villa, because it's still a significant step in progress.
Yeah, especially if you were one of the people that thought we'd be finishing 17th again and just trying to escape relegation. We've done that. We obviously won't go down now. But like you said, I will be disappointed, because this was probably the season we could have gone on to do bigger things. But Jack Grealish missing for, I don't know, 8 games or 10 games or however many it ends up being is going to hurt anyone, isn't it? So Matty Lang says, am I the only one who thought there were some positives from that? Is it a case that we were competitive with Liverpool for 80 minutes or whatever it was?
I was competitive, thinking, you know, in quotes. During the last, before Liverpool scored, so in the last 10 minutes, I thought, you know, what about if, I know it's a different Liverpool team, but Liverpool have gone into the top four, haven't they, I think, for a couple of hours anyway. What about if we were at the top, you know, I'm thinking back to 10 years ago, and we're a Martin O'Neill team, and we're competing in that area ourselves. If you'd have gone to Liverpool and got a point, got a 1-1, with a team that was knocking around the top four, and you were knocking around that area, you'd have felt quite, you know, you've taken that point, wouldn't you? And you thought it's a decent point. And I know Liverpool aren't quite at it at the moment, but I think if we'd come away with a point, I think it would have been decent. But yeah, so I think there were positives there in that sense. I mean, I thought Emi Martinez did really well. I knew as soon as the commentator said that, you know, it's Brad Friedel's kind of 11-year record for clean sheets, I thought, well, okay, that's at least one goal going in. But I thought he was brave. I thought he was commanding. I thought Liverpool were obviously brighter in the first half an hour or so. And when they were kind of pinging, I think Alexander-Arnold put a couple, didn't he, into that six-yard area. When they were doing that, Martinez was taking complete control of it, and thought he was unlucky, really unlucky to finish on the losing side today. Talking about the commentators, it just made me laugh about Carragher when he, wow. And you think, oh my God, have I missed something? Has he received a text message? Gary Neville sent nudes or something? You know, what's going on there? And then they play it back again. And listen, It's a decent, you know, the ball's come high out of the sky. It's a decent enough touch. I don't think he kills it dead. I think this is Firmino, by the way. Carragher, you've probably all seen it during the match, but Carragher just kind of starts gushing about this moment, and you wonder if, you know, somebody showboated and done a 360 and an overhead kick and stuff. And no, it's a footballer controlling a football. But yeah, it just amused me. And I mentioned it on Twitter. Somebody saying, "Oh, Matt, but it was a decent touch." I thought it was a decent touch, but I mean, I saw I remember Andy Townsend once, he pulled a ball out of the sky. It got snow on it. It was so high out of the sky. It had been launched out of orbit. He was standing on the touchline near the Witten Lane stand. And there were three opposition players around him. And he killed that dead. To me, that was a wow moment. Not a Brazilian footballer controlling half controlling a football, you know, in an empty ground with the run of the with the run of the centre circle. But you know, listen,
it's funny you should say that. You know, you kind of weren't watching, and what have you missed? I was on. I think I was on Facebook doing a post. I think, and I've got my laptop open, and I'm half paying attention, and I didn't see what happened. But Hurricane would go, "Oh wow!" And I'm like, "Oh, what was that? What was that?" And they showed the replay of him bringing the ball down. And, you know, sometimes when they show the wrong replay or they've not quite got to it yet, yeah. I was thinking that that would just happen, and they're about to Carragher be like, "Oh, this is what we're just seeing." The fact that he's like watched it back, he's like, "Oh, great touch." Like you said, yeah, it was a good touch, but it's Fabinho, cost millions and millions of pounds, a professional footballer in open space playing for Liverpool at home against Aston Villa. It's like, you know what I mean? I expect nothing less. It's almost like when we massively praise up goalkeepers for making a save and then they'll do an injury. It's like, that's my job to keep the ball out of the net. And it's like, oh yeah, a bit of perspective.
What's the alternative to him trapping that ball? It bouncing off his leg?
Yeah, exactly.
And then what do we say? It's
strange.
You know, exactly. It was... it's funny you say that about you not watching it, and then the wow alert you. Lad I used to work with just tweeted me saying I was just unloading the dishwasher at the time, and I nearly jumped out my skin when I heard Carragher saying that. You're thinking, oh, I don't know. It's like, you know, it's like me looking out my window now and like seeing a leaf blowing around the garden and going, oh my goodness, wow.
Yeah, anyway, what you expected. We're going to talk about a couple of things. We're going to talk about the wingers, Tyra Mings and Dean Smith, because there's a load of comments coming in saying, talk about this, talk about that. We're going to get to everything. We're just trying to go in order. Talk about Tyra Mings. A few comments earlier in the stream, people saying that he's the most overrated footballer in the Premier League, overrated defender. He's playing for England, and as we constantly isn't, liability, the usual buzzwords that go around every time that Tyra Mings does something that isn't to his usual standards. What's your opinion of Tyra Mings? We talk about him in little bits here and there when he does something either really good and we go, oh yeah, great little turn, or he does something really bad. Is he overrated? Should he not be in the England squad? Is he where we need to improve in the summer? What's your opinion of Tyra Mings?
I'm less fussed about him in the England squad, to be honest, because I think he's certainly good enough to be in Aston Villa's starting lineup. I think the fact that he is in the England squad has probably led some people to believe that he's overhyped and that he believes his own hype. I don't think that's the case. I don't think it's the case that he's got arrogant or complacent from being in England. I think, you know, listen, he got away with one when he's let the ball slip through for Salah today, and Salah should have scored. You know, he should have done better for the goal when Salah did score. So he's centre-half. It's his job to stop opposing strikers scoring goals, and it's his job to keep goals out of Villa's net. So in that sense, he's not done it today. You know, we're talking about one of the best strikers in the world in terms of Mo Salah, who absolutely loves scoring against Villa. I think he's carried on where Robbie Fowler left off many years ago of scoring against Villa virtually every time he plays. I don't think he's the world's best defender ever. I don't think he's the second coming of Paul McGrath here, but neither do I think he's the second coming of, I don't know, Jose Angel Crespo, whatever his name is. I think he can be somewhere. I think he's a good defender, and I don't know why we want to just leap and kind of throw hate his way, basically. That's not to say he can't be criticised, because he dropped a ball last week against Fulham. You know, so he's given one there. He's nearly given another one today. So he needs to be better. His concentration needs to be better. He's playing alongside, fortunately, he's playing alongside somebody in Ezri Konsa, who is really unflappable, you know, and doesn't make many mistakes at all. So should Konsa be in the England squad ahead of Mings? Possibly should, yeah. But should Tyra Mings and Ezri Konsa be Aston Villa's centre-back partnership for the rest of this season and beyond? Yeah, they should as well, because, you know, I think they're both really, really good players, and I think they're a good partnership. That's not me just excusing Mings making mistakes, because he needs to be better than that.
Mm. he seems to polarise opinion so much, probably more so than any other player in the Villa squad at the moment. Even just looking at the comments, someone says Ming's average at best. Someone else says he's static. And somebody else says he's class. Three different opinions there. He's either very good, average, or nowhere near it. And I don't really feel like you get that with some of the other Villa players, apart from maybe the wingers. We'll talk about the wingers in a minute. I've had a great tweet about Traore, but I don't know where I lie with Mings at the moment. Is it because he's next to Konsa that his low lights are more noticeable?
I don't know. I think, and I might be speaking completely out of turn here, but I think because Tyrone Mings is a kind of vocal presence on social media, you know, he's a very public side of Tyrone Mings, isn't that? You know, we've seen that he's really strong with what he believes politically, and he wants to be more than just a footballer. He wants to use his football platform to kind of change the world in a better way. I think that's great. I think that's great that we've got footballers who want to do that. And I think because he puts himself out there so much, he kind of invites it, you know. And I think didn't he when some of the fans turned against El Ghazi towards the end of last season, he was getting some stick to the point that he shut down his own Twitter account. As soon as El Ghazi comes back and scores a winner or something, Mings has kind of gone on there, hasn't he, and spoke really kind of in defence of El Ghazi and having a pop at the critics. And I think sometimes people don't like that. They don't want people to be that in your face. I don't mind it, to be honest. I quite like it. But when that happens and you make mistakes yourself, there's going to be a certain number of people waiting for you. Now, I think that's different from people who criticise him as, you know, who abuse him for his football. I don't think he is a terrible defender. I think he's prone to making mistakes. But, you know, there's lots of defenders. You know, these John Stones, who's probably going to start for England in the Euros, who's prone to making mistakes. Thing is, when you make mistakes in the Premier League, there's millions of people watching you, especially when you're a defender and it leads to a goal. Ezri Konsa, he's barely put a foot wrong, so he has been the better football. He has been the better player out of that partnership. But also, how much do we know about Ezri Konsa? How much does he put himself out there publicly? You know, it's a cliche, but he lets his football do the talking, and he doesn't kind of invite that on himself by being out there. And I'm not saying Tyrone Mings should step away from it and be quiet, because, like I said, I'm a fan of him being this ambassador for Villa. But I think there's those two things. A, Konsa has been better, so Mings is gonna look worse in comparison. And B, Konsa just goes about his everyday life seemingly with a minimum of fuss, whereas Tyrone Mings puts himself out there. I mean, that's my theory, Dan. I don't know. Does that any of that make any sense? Or
it makes sense, but I've not seen the recent comments yet. But I can already see people or envisage people saying, "Well, what he does off the pitch shouldn't matter. He will make a mistake in a game; it will cost Villa, and that's what annoys me."
No, I agree. I agree, but I think there is. I think the, and I'm not saying it's anybody who criticises Minks. Anybody who criticises Minks is doing it from that viewpoint. But I think there are a degree of people who have kind of made him the scapegoat because of that. And there's some who've made him a scapegoat because he's made more mistakes than the man alongside him, which is understandable.
The flip side of that argument from Dan Wilkes, he says, but does Konsa look good because he's got a commanding centre-back partner in Mings next to him? Is it that their partnership makes Ezri Konsa better?
Well, you know, I think that's an interesting, I think that's a really interesting way of looking at it, because, yeah, I think they are. I think Villa's back five is a partnership as well, or a team. And I think when Mings is caught in possession for overplaying, and that I think that's unforgivable, to be honest. He should know, you know, I know he came to the game to the Premier League late, but he should know when to give it and when to hang on to it a bit longer. I'm not sure that the worrying thing for me is these couple that have crept in the last couple of games. Like the one today was just a complete lapse where he's normally kind of, he doesn't normally do that. He doesn't normally let the ball run under his foot or, you know, misplace a pass like he did last week. So that's a worrying trend for me. But yeah, it tends to be the Barkley and Mings show, doesn't it? When we don't win the game, we tend to dig out the, uh, dig out those scapegoats. And I don't think it's fair, to be honest.
Yeah, let's get away from the Mings debate and push on to the wingers then. We've talked a lot when we speak about wingers, you often refer to them as being flaky, that, you know, that's what a winger is sometimes. But you've got three there in El Ghazi, Trezeguet and Traore, and I still can't put my finger on who's the best and worst of the three. They're all just a bit of a muchness, and I think Ash said on a previous episode that if they all had a bit of each of them combined together, we'd have a half-decent winger on our hands. I had a tweet during the game talking about Traore specifically from a guy called Tom Hanks Pants. I'm sure we've referenced him before because the name made us laugh. But he said, please, 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 can you discuss Traore in the post-match podcast? I need someone to explain why he's considered decent. He's consistently gives the ball away, usually in spectacular fashion. What do you think about Traore? Because again, I flip-flopped all over the place here. He'll do something brilliant, like the goal against Albion. And I think, oh yeah, good little tardy player in there. And other times, I just think, oh, what's he doing? I just don't see what he brings. And then you replace him with El Ghazi or Trezeguet. I think, Christ, they don't bring anything either.
Oh, mate, between them, they're really flakier than an ice cream van full of 99s. So I just wanted to get some really crapper opinion. Traore, I don't know. I think he's dined out on enough good moments. You know, kind of, has he scored half a dozen goals, I think?
Five, six, maybe, yeah.
I think, you know, we've said it before, haven't we? Villa definitely need an upgrade in that part of the pitch. I think Trezeguet is probably my favourite of the three, just because you notice him, don't you? And listen, sometimes you notice him because he's missing chances. But he just this sounds really harsh, but with Trezeguet, you think that perhaps he's lacking a little bit of quality, but he'll try and do as much as he can. Do you know what I mean? It sounds very patronised, you know. He'll have a go, you know. He'll try. Yeah. And I think that's why I put him above the others, because he will try and impact a game. And, you know, I always do this, Dan. I always try and get plugs in for future podcasts and stuff like that. And we've got Steve Froggatt coming up next week. And I don't think we asked Steve Froggatt about this particular thing, so it's not a spoiler. But I've spoken to Steve Froggatt before, and he said to me, as a winger, what you have to do is, even if you're not getting the ball or you're not beating your man and it's not happening, you've got to show the manager and show the crowd that you're there and that you're doing stuff. And I think Trezeguet does that, even if it's kind of the extra tracking back that he does. And I think, I thought he was really unlucky today, actually. And I don't know whether we've had an update on the injury that's whether Smith's spoken about it yet at his post-match. He looked to be in some kind of pain and some kind of discomfort. But what I loved about Trezeguet today was he's hit that shot against the post, it's come back, and he's done absolutely everything he can to get on the end of his own rebound. Mm-hmm. He was never going to head the rebound in, but the fact that he even tried just shows that, you know, he cares, he really cares. And that's not to say that Traore and El Ghazi don't care, because people, do you know what I mean? People conduct themselves in different ways. But for me, yeah, I'd put Trezeguet at the currently anyway. I'll probably change my mind next week because I'm flakier than those three, but I put Trezeguet as the chief of those three wingers at the moment. I still don't think I'd want Trezeguet to be starting in a Villa team next season. You know, I think we need to seriously upgrade. Just again, like we said earlier in the podcast, so that we can start having that vibe of players around Ollie Watkins who are going to deliver the goods more often than not.
Yeah, I think that's the main point there, isn't it? Regardless of how good the three of them are this year, probably all three of them won't be around the squad next year. Do you expect one of them or more of them to leave the club even, rather than just go down to be backup? It's a lot of money, isn't it, to have sit on the bench?
Yeah, I think one of them will go. I think, you know, I think we'll upgrade in that position so that you know, hopefully Jack Grealish is back. Well, he will be back by then. Hopefully Jack Grealish is occupying one of well, you never know. Yeah, what did we say, a couple of weeks? Yeah. So yeah, listen, they definitely need to upgrade in that position, but I don't think we started with giving away anything. Any trade secrets there, are we?
again, to polarise his opinion, Trezeguet always works so hard, he's the last winger I'd want replaced, says Patrick, and then the face says Trezeguet's rubbish. And Neil says he's like a fan that has won a contest to play for the team. I don't know, it's just...
I don't know whether that is a compliment or a criticism? It's a criticism of his ability, that he's not, he's won a prize, he's not a professional footballer, he's won a prize, but we always say that we want play like a fan. And I'm sure he's meant to criticism, but we want players to play and give absolutely everything. And I think he does that.
Yeah. I'm trying to find a comment from earlier. I'm trying to find a comment, just funny comments. I'm trying to find one about Dean Smith. I think it's gone past now, which is annoying. I don't think I can scroll back far enough. But it was along the lines of the Smith out stuff, and there's been links to Steven Gerrard coming this week. That's the wrong one. Taking over as manager and all these kind of different rumours spouting about. We've talked a lot about Dean Smith. Should he stay and should he go? And every week it seems to change. I'm intrigued to see what the comments on this episode say about him. You know, he's gone as far as he can and doesn't make the right subs and yada, yada, yada. Is this going to be just the recurring theme now for the rest of the season, that Villa aren't going to get into Europe and aren't going to go down? So every game we win, we're going to go, yeah, part of the project, long term, he's going to turn us round, a few more signings in the summer and we'll be fine. And every time we lose, we'll say, Dean Smith out, get rid of him.
I don't like the precedent it was set. If you've got a manager, or in any work walk of life, you've got somebody who hits every objective that's expected of them year on year, improves year on year, and you say, you're not good enough. You know, what does that mean? Does that mean that if Dean Smith, within the first year, within the second year of the Premier League, has got to qualify for Europe, otherwise he's not good enough? I don't get it. You know, okay, we know that Villa have had a really, really strong start to this season that put them in good shape and that probably could have kicked on and made this season a lot stronger than it was. But, you know, Smith's got Villa, and, you know, and I know what we'll get back in the comments, because people will say that it was Jack Grealish who did this, and it was Jack Grealish who did that, and it was Jack Grealish who signed Ollie Watkins, and it was Jack Grealish who signed Tyrone Mings to get us up, and it was Jack Grealish, and almost kind of airbrushed the part that Smith played in it. Dean Smith came in to a Villa squad, you know, that was drifting. You know, it was a decent squad still, I think, that he inherited from Steve Bruce, albeit a bit imbalanced, but somehow. And maybe it was because he got the X factor with Jack Grealish, but he's still got to get Jack Grealish in a team that can win Villa enough matches to get into the Premier League. He's done that. He's delivered it. You know, and last season, I'll be honest, I think we've said this before, the break in the season because of lockdown restrictions, I think saved Dean Smith's job and saved Aston Villa's Premier League status last season. But Dean Smith and his coaches used that wisely to hatch a plan that just about kept Villa up by the skin of the teeth. And Dean Smith and the people around him got the recruitment right that meant that Villa could take that next step by bringing in areas of quality. So Villa have gone forward at every single stage, every single season since Smith's been here. They've gone forward. Now, they might not have gone forward at the pace that people want them to go to. And next season, they might not go forward. They might go backwards. And if they go backwards, that's the time when you can have the conversation. But until now, I mean, what kind of message does that send out if you get rid of a guy who has actually achieved everything and, you know, arguably overachieved? I just don't get it. It's a nonsense to me.
I agree. I'm fully agree with your point. But to try and play devil's advocate to represent people that are watching, there's people saying he's taken us as far as we can go, and without Jack Grealish, his record speaks for itself, and there's no plan B, etc. I'm trying to scroll through and summarise what a few people are saying, that he's, you know, for Villa to take this step to that next level, it can't be with Dean Smith. And I always find a little bit difficulty with comments like that, or opinions like that, that trying to read the future. Oh, Dean Smith can't get us into Europe. Dean Smith can't attract these quality players. Based on what? Do you know what I mean? Like, why? We haven't seen that he can't get us into Europe yet, so you can't categorically rule out that he can't take us all the way, that he can't do this, he can't do that, because we've not seen it. We were mid-table in the Championship when he came, and we're now mid-table in the Premier League within 2 years, 3 years. Why would he then be sacked? And then if you're sacked, who do you replace him with? Who can take us to the next level? Do you know what I mean? Who is available that can take us into Europe, or can attract these players that can do the things that Smith apparently can't?
Well, let's look at who can't, because I'll give you some names. Roberto Di Matteo, Steve Bruce, Alex McLeish, Tim Sherwood, Paul Lambert, Remy Gard, you know, and so on. You know, we've had all these people who have tried, and they've come from different places with different reputations. And all of those, to one degree or another, Alex McLeish might beg to differ. We had Alex on the podcast, and he still paints that season as a season of, you know, he's delivered what was asked of him. But they've all failed, haven't they? In one way or another, they have all failed of what of the objectives that their boss, so the CEO or the chairman at the time, they have all failed to deliver. Dean Smith has succeeded. For the last three seasons, he's succeeded. So I'm not saying that Dean Smith shouldn't be bright around his substitutions. I'm not saying that by now Dean Smith shouldn't have found a way with the players at his disposal to be constantly competitive when Jack Grealish isn't there. But there's a big difference to me between debating whether Dean Smith could do his own job better than there is debating whether somebody could do the job better than Dean Smith. I think we're a long way off that. I hope we are anyway.
Again, I agree with you, but again, I want to try and put the other side across as much as I can. There's people saying, well, the other managers that you mentioned didn't have the money that Smith had. He spent $200 million in two seasons, so he should be doing better with that money spent.
So does that mean that everybody in the Premier League who spent $200 million, you know, should there be 12 clubs in the top six? You know, yeah. Villa have 2 years in the Premier League, so Dean Smith is playing catch-up because of all those managers before him, because of the way the club was badly run before him. So why shouldn't a manager who's achieved and succeeded the objectives that have been placed on him, why shouldn't he be the one who benefits from Villa being in a better place to have that money to spend? And why shouldn't he be the one who's given that to try and do with what he can? Do you know what I mean?
The money argument is a strange one to me, because people want a better squad and they want us to have a plan B and they want squad depth. So the year that we come up, we have to replace all the ageing players that we left in the Championship and all the loanees. So you have to spend that money. So I kind of, I'm going to write off 100 million odd and 12 players, but we had to make those signings to put a squad together. So don't read massive amounts into that. And like we've said before, it's 10 million per player, which on average is pretty cheap for the Premier League anyway. And this year we spent 80, 90 million or whatever it was on five or six players that have come in and improved the first team. That's what building the squad is about, and putting a team together that tries to get into Europe. So it's not like it. You can say, oh, we spent 200 million, but it's not wasted 200 million. It's not spent 200 million and got relegated. It's spent 200 million and got into mid-table in the Premier League. Surely that is proof that the concept's worked.
Spent 200 million and move Villa forward. And, you know, I think it's this kind of microwavable meal mentality, again, where people just want things straight away. You know, we can't wait for this. We haven't got the patience to wait for this team and this squad and this vision to be realised kind of organically, if you like. We need it yesterday. You know, we've shown that we can batter Liverpool 7-2, so why aren't we battering every team 7-2 every week? And the ones who aren't, the one, you know, and if we're only winning 6-2, then let's drop two of the strikers. And then we've conceded two, so let's get rid of those defenders, because they, you know, he switched off at a corner. So let's forget him and let's bring the next one in. It's not the way the world works, is it? Well, it probably does. The Premier League does work like that, and you know, football fandom probably does work like that, with people having unrealistic expectations. But we're on an even keel now. We've got a really solid footing with good owners and a good kind of manager, CEO, director of football, kind of, you know, scouting model that works. Listen, if Villa were in a relegation battle again, we could say, listen, this guy's not learnt any of his lessons, he's not improved, but we've improved. Well, I don't know why I wasn't expecting a Dean Smith
but this is the conversation, is it? Like I said, every time we lose, it's that, oh, he's done as much as he can, find somebody else. That's the conversation. That's the narrative that comes around. And again, there's still comments. And I'm trying to play two sides of the coin here, because my personal opinion is, you can say with Dean Smith and you trust in the project, trust the process, or whatever buzzword you want to go with. So when I highlight any comments, I'm not singling out that person. I'm just trying to use them as the other side, so to speak, not to make it us first them. But Mighty Villain says, 200 million for mid-table obscurity. That's what I'm talking about. But, yeah. How much has Man City had to spend to win titles? How much did Liverpool have to spend to win the title? I think 200 million to get into mid-table is the going rate, isn't it? pretty much. You've got to spend lots of money to get into Europe. That's why Villa haven't been able to do it, because we don't have the squad. If we spend another 100 in the summer, then you look and say, well, Dean Smith has gone from mid-table championship, spent 300 million to get Villa into Europe, we'd all be going, that's pretty decent, actually. That's what we'd needed to do to take that step.
When did 10th in the Premier League, when did 10th in the Premier League become mid-table obscurity for Aston Villa? Because I remember having a conversation, I don't know.
Also, we've longed for this for a long time. How many rubbish years did we have in the Premier League? In the Championship, where I go, God, I'd kill for being 10th and safe by April. I'd love that now. I'd love to be boring and be safe with 10 games to go. We wanted that for a long time. Now we've got it. It's not enough.
Well, yeah, like I said, mid-table obscurity would have been an absolute dream, wouldn't it? You know, and we knew then how much Villa had spent.
Yeah.
And I knew Villa had spent knocking on another 100 million last summer, and I still, 10th would have been beyond my wildest dreams. And if Villa would have finished 15th, 14th off the back of that, I wouldn't have called for Dean Smith's head on the back of them finishing 14th or 15th.
Hmm.
I don't know. Listen, people are obviously entitled to their own opinions. Villa, and we know we've got that lot down the road who always managed to outdo us in terms of being a joke football club. But until the current regime and until Dean Smith and the owners and Christian Purslow came in, I thought Villa were in danger of being a kind of a comedy club, really, with some of the things that were happening towards the end of the Randy Lerner era and all of the Tony Jarre era. I think we're a well-run football club now with grown-ups who understand that, yes, we want to be ambitious and we want to look forward and we want Villa to kick on and start to compete and start to challenge, but we're not going to do that at the expense of gambling, you know, over projecting, if you like. And it's boring when you don't win football matches and you're a steady, you know, you're a steady Eddie football club that's trying to grow carefully and slowly. It's not as fun as a chairman coming in and playing table tennis with the goalkeeper and, you know, writing transfer equations and, you know, saying we're going to be bigger than Barcelona in 5 years. You know, well run is not as exciting as that, but it paves the way for something that can be as exciting as that. If Villa start going backwards under Dean Smith, I'll be the first one to say, listen, thanks for all you've done. It's been, you know, it's been an enjoyable ride, but we're not going to kick on with you. I don't think we've reached that. I don't think we're anywhere near reaching that.
What is that? What counts as backwards? Is that actually being relegated or being in trouble for a season and then getting rid during the season? What counts as going backwards at this point?
I suppose it's finishing below this where you were the previous season, to be honest.
So Villa finished 12th this year and then we're on course to finish 14th the following year. You'd be wanting to change the manager then?
I think it depends on what level of investment had come and what the objective was at the start of the season. You know, if Villa finished 12th this season and then the vibe in the summer is we need another centre-forward to help Watkins, we need another midfielder or a couple of midfielders, we need a couple of wingers. You know, if Villa kind of spend big and have this big statement that, okay, we've been here a couple of years, we now really mean business, and it flatlines and there's no discernible kind of progress or Villa fall backwards, then you'd have to look at the whole thing, wouldn't you? And you'd have to say, well, was the recruitment right? Was the, you know, what did the manager do? You know, were the players that we signed any good? And I think there'll be time. There'll obviously be time for inquest. There'll be an inquest or an investigation into this season. But what will it show? It will show that Villa have moved forward.
Yeah, I agree. And it's probably a good time to wrap up this podcast as we've talked for almost 50 minutes. And for those that enjoy serious football chat, this podcast has been that. And hopefully we've put both sides of the argument on the Dean Smith debate, amongst other things, to you. But for those still watching live, that was very heavy. Have you got any silly nonsense for me before I can go on with the rest of my day? That's like a very serious chat for you, mate. You've normally got something.
Have you watched Ozark? Do you watch Ozark on Netflix?
No, I've not seen
it. Oh, it's all right. I've come to it a bit late. And do you know the premise of it though? I won't somebody who launders drugs money. Anyway, but I've not really come across this fella much before who's in it, this actor called Jason Bateman. But he actually played, he did the voice of the fox in, is it Zootropolis? Zootropolis?
I've not seen
it. Anyway, basically, I'm deep in this kind of binge watching this at the moment. But so there's this real kind of serious kind of drugs money launderer, but I can't get out of my mind the fact that he's a cartoon fox. So I just wonder whether anybody shared my kind of let's stick to pork chops, mate. I'm losing people with this. So I've got nobody with this.
That's an interesting point there when you see somebody in something else and you just think, oh, that's so-and-so from whatever. I've done that before. I can't think of a specific example, but once you've seen somebody like in Harry Potter or something, you go, oh, that's Harry Potter, and now he's doing serious acting, escaping from prison or whatever that thing is on Amazon. It's Harry Potter, use of magic. That's all I think.
Well, I can watch Tom Hanks in something serious without thinking there's Woody. Do you know what I mean?
You say that, but we watched Castaway the other night, and when he's on the beach and he's got Wilson, the ball, and he's moaning about whatever it is, and he's trying to start a fire or whatever, I said, close your eyes for a second. When he starts like screaming and wailing, I was like, it's Woody. So I do think Woody when I hear Tom Hanks, if I close my eyes. So when someone is as famous and that, and they've been in everything, you do think, oh yeah, it's Woody.
Yeah, well, listen, get onto Ozark. It's good. But before you watch it, is it Zootropolis or Zootopia?
I think it's the Zootropolis thing, yeah. Maybe you should watch them. I'll watch them the other way around, and I'll wonder whether it's Jason Bateman's character in Ozark as the fox instead. Maybe that'll make Zootropolis a better watch for me.
I wonder if, like a drug dealer. I wonder if, is a drug dealing fox worse than a foxy drug dealer?
God.
Right. We're done.
I think we're done. I just wanted to give you mentioned the Steve Frog podcast earlier, and just want to give it a plug. I've got a clip lined up that we'll play to end this episode because I've loaded it into the system anyway, so we might as well use it. I put together a little trailer, which you said on WhatsApp was one of the best ones we've done, which is praise from you. I don't normally get praise.
I enjoyed it, mate. It brought it all flooding back. I mean, we've had some feature length ones, haven't we, lately? I mean, the Brian Little one was an epic, 100 minutes long. How tight did you cut the Froggy one down?
Froggy is an hour. It's bang on an hour.
Because I think it's, and again, I am going to big it up, but it's full of kind of great, I mean, the trailer's brilliant, but it's full of kind of great, funny stories. But there's some real kind of poignant moments about kind of some of the setbacks in his career as well. So, I think it's brilliant. And we tend to have some good feedback on the YouTube comments and on Twitter and stuff like that. But I love doing them. It's really, you know, I went for a walk with my dad this morning. I was just chatting, just general, just how things were. And he was asking me about work and stuff like that. And I just said, the podcasts, it's kind of, not these with you. I could take or leave these. But the ones with the former players, people say never meet your heroes. But the ones that we've done, not only have we kind of been on a journey down memory lane with them, but they've all been cracking out there. They've all been really, really good blokes as well. Really, really up for it and having a laugh and stuff like that. So
The little bits like pre-recording and after recording are good when we're talking to them just casually. It's not like, we've said 12, like, let's start. And then they have to like turn it on. They're just normal blokes. And I tweeted the Froggy trailer saying, like, I say it every episode, and I do say it every episode, that the newest one always becomes my favourite pretty much. That's a bit of a cliched, stupid thing to say, but like they just keep getting better. But we've not. There will be a period where that's wrong, and that'll be harsh on whoever that is. I go, actually, that wasn't as good as Brian Little, whoever. But so far, it's always like, oh, Froggy surpasses my expectations. We've got John Gregory coming up. That's a massive long one. That's really good as well. And every time one comes out, I go, great bloke to speak to. So good. This is my favourite podcast. And I'm wondering when we get to that peak where I go, actually, that wasn't that good.
I love I'm looking forward to that when you promote it on social media and you at the person in and you go, yeah, take or leave this one, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly. Right, we'll get out of here. Thanks everyone who joined with our post-match chat this afternoon. We appreciate all your comments as always. And thanks, Matt, for joining me as well. We'll close out this little Facebook Live and podcast with Steve Froggy. Steve Froggett. The full podcast will be out on Tuesday, so come back for that. And thanks for watching. And we'll end with Froggy stories.
And I had to knock on the first team door, and I had to go get on my hands and knees and bow down and go, "Blom bombshell, please may I clean your boots?" I literally got a right good kick in and got chased around the training ground by Platy, Alan McAnally. I remember once being thrown headfirst into a dustbin because I didn't do his boots. From the moment Dino arrived from Liverpool, I made him goal after goal after goal after goal. Literally every week, I was putting it on the plate for him. So we've gone into the players' bar this one night, and he's introduced me to his wife as the person who just made them their second million. So in the early days, Steve Staunton used to hit the ball. I'd be 5 yards away from him like an Exocet missile. I said, can you not just lay it into me so I can actually on the half turn it? And I went, you're not playing with John Barnes now, you know. And he went, don't I know it. When I retired, my missus said to me, you've been asked to do a modelling job. And I'm thinking, okay, fine. So when we got there, they've gone, right, makeup. They only painted us as lions. I'm now not happy. I've got in my car. I'm fuming now because I was going on to another gig. Piling down the motorway and I've gone through 2 speed cameras because I'm just oblivious to what's going on. I've got a speed thing coming through. I'm thinking, I can't remember when that would be. So I said to her, I said, look, were you driving my car that day? Ask for the official photographs. But 2 weeks later, photos come on. Big head of a lion, it's me. I think they felt so sorry for me, thinking, our life must have been so tough for this. Like, if he was a professional footballer and he's got to do this for a living now, we'll just let him off.
Thank you for listening to Claret and Blue, an Aston Villa podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, then please do let us know. We love hearing your feedback. We'll be back soon with another episode, but until then, up the Villa.